Okay, we're glad to have all of you this morning. We appreciate your interest in a subject that is very much at the top of the priority list for our organization, the Nuclear Threat Initiative, which, as you know, is a nonprofit organization that works on the nuclear, chemical, and biological threat and is doing everything we can to stimulate governments around the world to try to do all the things that are needed to do to prevent catastrophic terrorism. So that's the heart of what we're all about, and that's what we're talking about here today. Our organization, NTI, is proud to sponsor with Carnegie of New York the Global Partnership Project, an unprecedented consortium of 21 research institutions in 16 European, Asian, and North American countries. This consortium started really in concept in 1991 as Senator Lugar and I and others called for a global partnership against catastrophic terrorism. And the effort has been led very skillfully by CSIS, Center for Strategic International Studies, led by Michelle Flannery on my right and Bob Einhorn on my left. They've done an absolutely superb job. But it has been a partnership, and it has been spread across not only Europe but Asia, and also including specifically Russia. So there are 21 think tanks involved in this effort. We think it's unprecedented in terms of cooperation. In June of 1992, at their Kananaskis Summit in Canada, the group of eight nations announced the global partnership against the spread of weapons of mass destruction. I felt this was a major breakthrough at the time, and I still do. They pledged to raise up to $20 billion over the next 10 years, and that includes the Nunn-Lugar program in the United States, which, as most of you know who follow this, is being funded at about $1 billion a year. So it's really, in effect, a match. This pledge is a match of the United States' $10 billion, 10-year planning program on the Nunn-Lugar by the G8 countries. That was the pledge. And the pledge was directed to reduce the risk that unsecured weapons or materials of mass destruction might fall into the hands of terrorists. And I think most people now recognize that the most likely use of weapons of mass destruction would be by terrorist groups. Since that announcement by the G8, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, Finland, Poland, and the Netherlands have become members of the partnership, and I want to commend particularly Canada for being a very active and effective leader in not only hosting the original conference that came up with this pledge of the G8, but also following through. Our 21 non-governmental member consortium, which is an outside group, of course, we've mentioned led by CSIS, has hosted conferences in Moscow, London, and most recently we put on a war game with the Europeans in Brussels about 2 weeks ago. In addition, under CSIS leadership, this consortium has put out a four-volume report setting forth the threat and the plan of action to close the gap between the threat and response. This morning, this report is being updated by Michelle and Bob. In 2 weeks, the G8 leaders will meet in Sea Island, Georgia, for their annual summit meeting. This is an opportunity for the G8 to show leadership and give renewed impetus to efforts to address the most urgent threat we face, the threat of weapons of mass destruction combined with terrorism. Prior to Kananaskis, the U.S. had been working on this problem for close to a decade under what are now called the Nunn-Lugar programs or cooperative threat reduction programs. But the challenge of securing potentially vulnerable weapons and materials was not really seen by other nations as a global problem, and others were content to let the United States shoulder the burden essentially by ourselves until recently. But 9/11 changed that. It exposed our vulnerabilities, and I think many nations in the world realized, correctly so, that we are not the only country subject to this kind of threat, that we're all involved, and this is a threat that affects everyone and no nation can solve by itself. So I think finally we're seeing motivation on the part of other countries to consider playing a more significant role in addressing these threats. That's the message of the pledge made 2 years ago in Canada. Real progress has been made under the Global Partnership. CSIS is releasing today a Global Partnership scorecard that outlines what has been done and what remains to be done. What the scorecard shows, however, is that there remains a very dangerous gap between the progress being made and the scope and the urgency of the response to meet those threats. We know, for example, that Al-Qaeda has been interested in acquiring nuclear weapons. We know that it is well within Al-Qaeda's operational capabilities to recruit the technical expertise needed to build a crude nuclear device. The hardest part for the terrorist is getting the nuclear materials necessary to build a bomb, and making that impossible has to be our goal. The good news is that we know where the potentially vulnerable materials are located. We know how to make them secure against theft or seizure. And unlike many other problems we face today, for instance, in the biological area, this one is finite. It's a big job, but it is finite and it is doable. The bad news is that our efforts to solve it are moving much too slowly. Hundreds of metric tons of inadequately secured bomb-making materials remain dispersed throughout Russia's network of nuclear facilities. The problem is not confined to Russia or even the former Soviet Union. There are about 130 nuclear research reactors and other facilities in 40 countries using highly enriched uranium, which is weapon-grade material. Many of these facilities have only the most rudimentary security measures. Programs are underway to address these problems, but so far they are not being pursued with the necessary sense of urgency, as if our lives depended on them, and our lives do depend on them. At the current rate, it will be many years before we can rest easy that terrorists cannot readily get their hands on the ingredients for building nuclear bombs. At the current rate that we've been going, we figured just on the research reactor problem, you'd take at least 20 years to get the job done. Maybe not even done in that time, depending on how many reactors really have HEU material. The good news, again, though, is that things are beginning to be done. At the outset of this initiative in January 2001, our organization, Nuclear Threat Initiative, identified what we believe was a dangerous gap between the threat from nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons and our response to these dangers. Today, the Department of Energy, under the leadership of Secretary Spencer Abraham, announced in Vienna a significant global effort to close that gap by securing nuclear and radiological materials in civilian research reactors. I commend and praise the Secretary for this initiative and for his candid recognition that past efforts have not been adequate to protect against the perils presented by these nuclear materials around the globe. I also note with great approval that the Department of Energy's initiative intends to work in partnership with Russia on these matters. Through my work in the Senate and the Nuclear Threat Initiative, I believe that U.S.-Russian cooperation and leadership in this area is not only fundamental, but it is also absolutely imperative. It is incumbent on Secretary Abraham to follow through on this, I think, significant breakthrough announcement this morning. It is also incumbent on President Bush and President Putin and the leadership of the G8 to work strenuously to deliver on these and other promises, to translate these commitments to concrete and urgent action. Even, however, if you assume that Secretary Abraham and his Russian counterpart, Rumyantsev, do their job and do it well, and even if you assume that the IAEA, where this announcement is being made, does its job well, only sustained, focused leadership from President Putin and from the other members of the G8, including, of course, President Bush, can remove the obstacles which pop up every time you start one of these initiatives, and those obstacles have to be knocked down, and they cannot be knocked down simply by the Department of Energy or the Department of Energy's counterpart in Russia. It will take President Bush, it will take President Putin, it will take the G8 leadership to basically remove the obstacles, stay on top of the situation, make this a front burner item, be able to be briefed on it every day by a high-level person, and having a high-level person in the White House and in the with access to the presidents and prime ministers, the top leaders in the world, on a daily basis. That's the only way you're going to cut through the obstacles. We've got about 12 years of experience, and we should have learned that, although it has not yet been acted on. This morning, I'm pleased to be joined by Michelle Flannoy and Bob Einhorn, two outstanding CSIS leaders who've had outstanding careers in government and continue to lead from the perspective of tremendous leadership outside of government. They will update us on the global partnership. They will also outline the positive developments and also very candidly the huge challenges that remain They will make it clear that the pledges have not yet reached the $20 billion goal that was made and established 2 years ago by the G8, and most pledges have yet to be turned into actual dollars and actual programs. So I'll turn it over to Michelle and Bob. I'm going to have a few comments when they conclude on the subject of leadership and specifically what we should expect out of the G8 with the kind of leadership that the threats demand. So, Michelle and Bob, take it.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming. As Senator Nunn said, the reason we've timed this discussion now is that Sea Island really presents a unique opportunity to make progress on an agenda that is probably one of the most important things that the world leaders can grapple with. And as Senator Nunn said, it's going to take leadership at the very top levels, the level of the U.S. president, the level of the Russian president, and other G8 leaders to remove some of the obstacles. The G8 Global Partnership has been a fantastic development, just the kind of cooperation that's needed to address the threat of catastrophic terrorism and to reduce the risks. But it's not been able so far to really go at the kind of pace that's needed to meet the threat. It has not had the kind of urgent action. If I may, sir, Senator Nunn likes to say that we're in a race between cooperation and catastrophe. And if I had to assess the situation, I'd say the terrorists like Al-Qaeda are definitely racing to get these materials and to use them. But we're sort of at a leisurely jog at this point. We've barely broken a sweat, and we're certainly not sprinting to try to lock down and secure these materials to prevent this from happening. Let me just briefly overview what you have here. We've provided a number of materials on the eve of the summit to try to help those of you who are going to be writing about these issues to provide some analytic basis for assessing where we are and what more needs to be done. The first item is what's called our Global Partnership Update. This is a quarterly publication. You'll see a summary of the Global Partnership itself, recent developments, different countries that have made different commitments, begun different programs, and so forth. An interesting interview with John Bolton, who's the U.S. Undersecretary who deals with these issues and a member of the Senior Officials Group, and also a recap of a nuclear terrorism exercise that we recently conducted in Europe to sort of jumpstart a dialogue within Europe about how Europe can step up to meeting the threat of WMD terrorism and really taking action to prevent such an event from occurring. The second document is a consortium statement that has a list of recommendations for the G8 leaders. And again, it's about 6, 7, 8 items here that we think are actionable, that leadership at the summit could actually move the ball forward in terms of securing various materials, reducing the threat in the nuclear, chemical, and bio arena. I think what's unique about this, again, is that this is not just the statement of one organization. This is a statement that 21 organizations from 16 countries around the world have agreed to, that this is the kind of agenda we should see coming out of Sea Island. So in some ways, it gives you a benchmark for assessing what comes out of the summit. The final document, and Bob's going to speak about this in more detail, is what we call the scorecard, which is a much more in-depth analysis of what's the nature of the problem in each of these areas? How much and what kind of nuclear material? Where is it? What's been done so far? What has been done to date? What is the work in progress? And what still needs to be done? What's the outstanding agenda, if you will? And really, at the bottom, a sort of summary of what the most important things we think are needed, the steps that are needed. Again, adding more specificity to the kind of recommendations that are made in the consortium statement. So we hope that these will provide some resources to all of you as you cover these issues. We'd also encourage you to check out our website, which is sgpproject.org. It's listed on all the documents here. And to certainly contact all of us as you work these issues and cover these issues going forward. So with that, let me turn to Bob and let him go into a little more depth on the scorecard and what the picture is.
Thank you very much, Michelle. This is I'm going to spend a few minutes on this document, Global Partnership Scorecard. It's a kind of balance sheet. It looks at progress that's been made to date, and evaluates how much of the task remains ahead of us. There's a lot of detailed information here. I recognize that. I'm not going to go into the specifics of that. You can do that afterward. I just want to highlight some of the key points. First, I'd like to focus your attention on this chart of the pledges made to date. You will recall that at Kananaskis in June 2002, G8 leaders agreed to raise up to $20 billion for this global partnership effort. And this $20 billion was a pledge for over 10 years. Now, it had been hoped that perhaps by Sea Island pledges could reach the $20 billion mark. That hasn't happened, and they're a bit short at $17 billion. That's an impressive sum, $17 billion, but let me try to put it in perspective. The pledges are essentially statements of intention over a 10-year period. They are not funds that have already been approved by parliaments and allocated to specific global partnership projects. The funds committed so far to specific projects in the global partnership are actually a rather small fraction of the total $17 billion, and that's to be understood. I mean, it's to be is what one would expect. But for reasons that we can discuss later on, Russia and several of the global partnership partners have been a bit slow off the mark in actually concluding the necessary agreements and getting specific projects underway. Another point about pledges that I would like to mention. From the outset, this consortium of 21 think tanks in 16 countries we've been talking about had considered the $20 billion pledge to be a floor, not a ceiling. We believed that to do the job properly, the world would have to devote more, considerably more than the $20 billion.
Bob, just on that one point, I can interrupt. There's a task force under Howard Baker and Lloyd Cutler that took place at the very end of the Clinton administration, poured over into the first part of the Bush administration. And their estimate, and all of these are estimates, you don't know precisely, but their estimate was to do the job in the former Soviet Union alone in terms of securing the vulnerable nuclear weapon-grade material would take $30 billion. So that gives you some perspective. And the global partnership G8 pledge is $20 billion over 10 years. This recommendation was moving with $30 billion over about 5 years, and that was 2 years ago. And that was before September 11th, 2001, 3 years ago. So that gives you some perspective. And also, the $30 billion that Cutler and Baker, bipartisan task force, basically did not include biological and chemical threat. So when you're looking at this, these are big numbers, but the job is a huge job, and it has to be put in perspective.
Anyway, I mentioned that our non-governmental consortium was calling for making the $20 billion a floor, not a ceiling. The U.S. government now has adopted that formulation. The administration regards the $20 billion now as a floor, not a ceiling, and is seeking to boost pledges even above the $20 billion. But as you can see from the chart and the specific allocations, the specific pledges made by countries, some of the partners are clearly doing less than their own fair share in even reaching the figure of $20 billion. Let me turn now programmatically to what the partnership has achieved and what remains. And I'm going to focus not so much on the detailed graphs, but on the summary boxes that appear at the end of each weapons category. We're focusing really on what are the top priorities, what's really needed to make this global partnership a success. And looking in the nuclear area, I think it's essential that we accelerate efforts to consolidate and secure nuclear materials in Russia that can be used to build nuclear bombs. Of the 600 metric tons of this nuclear material, the DOE, Department of Energy, is working to secure, less than half of that, or about 260 metric tons, has received security upgrades. The majority, or close to 60% of that material, has not received any upgrades, either initial rapid upgrades or more comprehensive upgrades. Now, the key factor impeding progress on this task of securing nuclear materials, interestingly, is not money. There are enough funds that have already been approved to keep the process on track. The problem has been a disagreement over how much access U.S. personnel should have at sensitive nuclear sites in Russia. That's really been the pacing factor. And it's a problem that can only be resolved at the highest levels. The bureaucrats are not going to be able to overcome this obstacle of inadequate access. And it's going to take presidential leadership both in Russia and in the United States to find a solution. What's also needed is a strong commitment to expedite what we have called the global clean-out of highly enriched uranium from research reactor sites throughout the world. As Senator Nunn mentioned, there are about 130 of these research reactors at about 40 countries throughout the world, and they operate with bomb-grade uranium, highly enriched uranium. Many of these were supplied by the United States, many supplied by the former Soviet Union. For a number of years now, the U.S. has had a program in place to remove highly enriched uranium from potentially vulnerable sites and to encourage the reactor operators there either to shut down the reactor or to convert them to use fuel that cannot be used in weapons, low-enriched uranium. The U.S. has also been cooperating for a number of years with Russia to remove highly enriched uranium from potentially vulnerable sites that the former Soviet Union supplied. And as Senator Nunn has pointed out, just today, Secretary of Energy Abraham mentioned an initiative to deal with this problem of the global clean-out of HEU. And if, in fact, this leads to a determined effort to prioritize the task and deal with the most vulnerable sites first, this will really prove to be a very important initiative. In the chemical area, what's needed is a drastic increase in the funds for the destruction of chemical weapons in Russia. After years of delay, the chemical weapon destruction facility at a place called Shucha is finally getting built. But there's an anticipated shortfall of about $6 billion in the funds that are necessary to get the total job of chemical weapons destruction in Russia finished. Destruction of chemical stocks in Russia will inevitably take a long time. At the very earliest, we're looking at 2012, but the process could well slip well beyond that. What we need is an urgent effort to try to provide better physical protection for chemical weapons stocks that are awaiting destruction. It will be a significant number of years that those enhanced physical security measures will be needed. So far, only 35% of Russia's nerve agent stockpile has received security upgrades.
I want to say one word on this one, Bob. Senator Lugar and I have been to Shucha on two occasions. There are about seven or eight buildings there, and in those buildings, the 1,971,000 tubes about this long, that size it would fit in a briefcase, of nerve gas. Each one of those tubes of nerve gas would kill 60,000 to 80,000 people if properly disseminated, and it's not that easy to disseminate chemical dispersal, but that's the potential power of them. If you go in those buildings, you go in with gas masks on, and you're all suited up because one leak of nerve gas and you're gone. You go in those buildings and you look, and there are stacks of those artillery tubes, and most of them are in a rusted form. You look at the ceiling, and there are holes in the ceiling. These are places, these are barn-like buildings where you wouldn't put a nice horse. And you look at the tubes, and they tell you they take inventory. Well, nobody's going to climb around a bunch of nerve gas and tap on the tubes and see if somebody substituted two or three of them and taken them out and substituted something else. So this is a ticking clock. They're also, the water table is coming up in that particular area. It's a very low area. It's a swampy area. So they've got a limited number of years to basically be able to keep those chemical weapons stored there. So you can't go to a place like this and come away with anything other than, as Senator Lugar has said on a number of occasions, a sense of real urgency that this is a lethal storehouse of weapons that would be a terrorist dream, and any one or two of them could cause tremendous havoc in the world. And the Russians want to get rid of it. And why we have let bureaucratic obstacles, and they have let bureaucratic obstacles get in the way, is unexplainable.
Finally, let me say a word about the biological weapons problem. We also need to take immediate steps to both account for and to secure potentially vulnerable biological pathogen collections, both in Russia and elsewhere in the former Soviet Union. We need to step up efforts to redirect scientific expertise, former Soviet biological weapons scientists, as well as the facilities they worked in, to peaceful uses. And that would include such activities as the retraining of these former weapons scientists, as well as the commercialization of certain biotechnology projects that are underway. For example, conversion of facilities to use them to produce vaccines. That's already underway. These kinds of commercialization projects need to be expanded. That's just a brief summary of some of the items that are in the scorecard, but I encourage you to take a closer look, and please come back to us if you have any questions.
Thank you very much, Bob and Michelle. Let me leave you with a few of my own hopes and aspirations, and some would say dreams, in the form of announcements, which I hope will emerge from this summit conference at Sea Island. And I must add at the beginning, we're very proud to have the summit and the G8 leadership in the state of Georgia. I have no official position now, but I'm very proud of Sea Island and all the work that Bill Jones and the whole team of coordinators have done at the local level to prepare for what is a very significant meeting. These are questions that I put in the form of questions, but they're really, this amounts to what I consider to be the imperatives of a global security agenda that this summit and these leaders should really address if they're serious and really focused on global security. Some of it comes from this report, some of them are my own, so I would not attribute these particular questions and goals to the consortium, although a number of them completely overlap. Number one, will the world leaders announce that they will appoint senior officials in their governments with direct access to the president or prime minister in each respective country who will be responsible and accountable for ensuring that terrorists do not acquire weapons or materials of mass destruction? Accountability at a high level, access to presidents, being able to overcome obstacles is the absolute key. Will they order their staffs to eliminate obstacles to cooperation? And Bob's already enumerated a couple of those, that if you had a nuclear explosion in a city and one of the great cities of the world went up in smoke, people would look back and say, how could our leaders possibly have allowed these bureaucratic obstacles to stand in the way? It's not explainable now, and it certainly wouldn't be explainable in a retroactive look at the cause of a disaster. Number two, will the leaders announce that they have reached their goal stated 2 years ago at the summit in Canada to add $10 billion to the U.S. $10 billion over the next 10 years to prevent terrorists from acquiring weapons of mass destruction or key materials to produce weapons of mass destruction. In other words, are the pledges going to be pledges or are they going to really be money? And is the money really going to be put into programs and put to work? Number three, will the leaders announce that they will make it a top priority to accelerate efforts to consolidate and secure usable weapon-grade nuclear materials wherever they exist in the world? And an important part of that question, will the G8 leaders endorse the commitment by the United States and by Russia, which was announced amplified on this morning in Geneva by Secretary Abraham, to accelerate the securing and removal of HEU from research reactors all over the globe? We need an endorsement by the G8 of this global clean-out announcement. We need an endorsement and a pledge of support because these reactors are located in countries all over the world. And the United States and Russia have influence in a number of these countries, but some of them we don't. And it's going to take world leadership to make this really happen. Number four, will the leaders announce plans for ensuring the safety and security of nuclear fuel from dismantled Russian submarines? This is an environmental nightmare ticking away. Nuclear reactors and submarines parked in the oceans of the world where fisheries are in proximate geographical vicinity. The Russians have this as a top priority. The United States doesn't have it as a top priority, but occasionally we need to listen to the Russians about their priorities if we expect them to listen to us about ours. So I think that's a very important question for the leaders. Number five, will the leaders, the G8 leaders, announce their plans for improving the physical security of all chemical weapon stocks awaiting destruction on an urgent basis? And as Bob mentioned, only 35% of those chemical stocks have now received what we call full security upgrades. Number six, will the leaders announce increased funding and an accelerated pace for the demilitarization of Russia's stockpile of 40,000 tons of chemical agents, which is now a $6 billion shortfall in funds? We've got to have conversion and environmental cleanup of these chemical weapon production sites. And the Russians have got to do their part, but they need help. Number seven, will the leaders announce immediate steps to secure dangerous biological pathogen collections across Russia and the former Soviet Union? And most importantly, will this include military and civilian openness and transparency? Right now we have civilian transparency in Russia on biological. We do not have military. And also, this is a question for our own government. Will the United States be willing to add a meaningful level of reciprocity here? At some point, the Russians, particularly the suspicious parts of the military and intelligence apparatus, say, why should we open up everything of ours without having reciprocity on the U.S. side? I think we've got to start dealing with that question. We've got to start understanding it. It's fundamental to our own security. And if we're not willing to have some element of reciprocity, there's a limit as to how far we're going to go down this line. So I think that's enormously important on the biological. And particularly in this I certainly do not contribute to the consortium, but will President Bush and President Putin at this summit or in some future summit in the near term announce bilateral transparency of both countries' biological defense research efforts, which are viewed with suspicion of offensive intent, each by the other country, and also suspicion of offensive intent by much of the world? This would be a major breakthrough and would unlock the backlog of problems and suspicions that affect the entire effort to prevent catastrophic terrorism. The biological suspicions pour right over into the nuclear cooperation or the lack thereof. I do not believe the United States is engaging in offensive biological research, but if other countries were doing exactly the same thing we were doing, we would believe they were engaging in offensive biological research. And so this is a matter of absolute fundamental matter of I think, some real urgency in dealing with Russia and dealing with the biological threat from terrorists. So I put that one near the top of my list. I would also add, I don't know what number we're on right now, but I'd add three or four more. Will the United States and Russia announce increased transparency and assurances of safety and security of tactical battlefield nuclear weapons in and around Europe? This is fundamental. Tactical, small battlefield nuclear weapons can be put in the back of a truck, driven into a major city, no more city if it explodes. These weapons, we don't know how many they are. We don't know where they're all located. We hope the Russians do. But this has got to be a matter of transparency. It's got to be a matter of reciprocity on both sides. Dealing with tactical nuclear weapons is an item that has not been on the agenda of President Bush and President Putin, and it has simply got to be on the agenda. And the G8 nations have to step up to the plate because these weapons are located near Europe and in Europe. And they've got to step up to the plate and put pressure on the United States and Russia leadership to deal with this problem. I'll add one more on the biological side and what I call the biological, the need for transparency of both countries' defensive research efforts. And that is, we could make a bilateral pledge here. We do not have to open this all up. This is a dangerous area to open up for total world transparency, but it can be done bilaterally. We can have transparency with the Russians. It would help us very much to have the kind of relationship with our biological scientists that we need in order to protect both the Russian people, the United States people, and the people of the world. And finally, the man from Mars test, this is Freddie Clay, his words, but and this goes beyond the consortium this morning, but I think it's essential to talk about. Freddie Clay says that if a man from Mars came down and looked at the Russian force structure now, the nuclear posture, and the United States nuclear posture, and saw the hair trigger on thousands of nuclear weapons with almost no decision time for either leader to make up their mind whether to start an all-out nuclear war if there were warning, could be an erroneous warning, false warning, that the man from Mars would say, what has happened in the last 12 years? Has the Soviet Union really gone away? Or have we kept a force posture that really related to a different world than we live in today? So dealing with the hair trigger alert status of thousands of weapons on both sides has to be a priority between President Bush and President Putin. It was talked about. I can get you the exact quote. President Bush made a pledge during his campaign to deal with this. He said that we need to take thousands of these weapons off of alert. We can get you the exact quote. It has not been dealt with. It has not been dealt with, it has not been made a priority, and it must be. And the final one, will we begin a step-by-step series of measures among the G8 and other countries to wage an all-out effort against infectious diseases and biological terrorism that includes significant and accelerated help to poor countries in the world where tens of thousands of people are dying of infectious diseases every day? The fight against biological terrorism and the fight against infectious diseases is the same fight. And it doesn't make sense to go around the world telling people we want your help on the biological terrorism aspect when they look back and say, thank you very much, we have 16,000 people a day dying in the poor countries of the world of infectious diseases. We've got to join both battles. The fight against infectious disease has always been a moral imperative, too often neglected. Now it is also a security imperative, because it joins together with the fight against biological terrorism. If you have a biological incident, you're not going to know whether it was a man-made or a nature-made incident, sometimes for weeks or months. So these are the same fight. Now, I view this list not as a list of impossible dreams, but as an essential and imperative set of global security challenges. And this is the way I judge leadership. I know it is a big job, but the outcome depends on dedicated, effective leadership by the President of the United States, the President of Russia, the leaders of G8, and other partners, countries around the globe. The real question for the leaders is whether preventing catastrophic terrorism is a global security priority for our leadership or an afterthought. And if it's an afterthought, my question is, after what? What is more important? So we are open for your questions.
With the announcement today of the global cleanout, what is the feeling of Russia's commitment to the effort, and what, if any, role can Russia play in getting the material out of that the U.S. supplied to Iran? That's been an issue of concern.
You want to take the Iran question?
Yeah, we provided U.S. provided a small research reactor to Iran a long time ago under the Atoms for Peace program. It's still there. In fact, when the IAEA came up with a report a little while ago suggesting that Iran was violating some of its nonproliferation obligations, that reactor was implicated. there was certain experimentation was done at the reactor that violated Iran's commitments. Obviously, we would like to see the reactor shut down and any remaining material there taken out of the country. But given the relationship between the U.S. and Iran today, it's going to be very difficult for U.S. leaders to persuade Iran to do that. I think the IAEA and perhaps the Russians could try to persuade Iran's leaders.
If you'd like me to answer on the Russia angle, I think, you know, the main role for Russia here is to accept the repatriation of material that originally came from Russia and to make sure that material is secure in Russia as it comes back, and eventually to feed it into the larger efforts to blend it down, into the form of uranium low enriched that cannot be used for weapons but can be used for power reactors and so forth.
I have a question about if Al-Qaeda has the recruiting potential to get anyone with expertise to put together weapons of these kinds, and North Korea, which it seems to be is emerging as like the Domino's pizza delivery boys of any sort of nuclear material you need, what the nexus of those two problems seems pretty big, and the U.S. hasn't seemed to done a lot to staunch that flow. What should be done in that department, and has the war in Iraq sort of distracted us from the real potentials here in weapons of mass destruction proliferation?
My own view is that the front burner should have always had North Korea on it. It should still be on the front burner. I think the threat from North Korea has always been and remains much greater than the threat from Iraq was or is. I do believe that we do not have good military options. To the extent that we had a military option at all, it was never a very good one. It disappeared when those rods were moved about a year ago out of the place where the research reactor is at Yongbong. When you look at North Korea, you look at a country that has demonstrated over the years they can dig tunnels everywhere, and they're pretty good at it. So locating fuel rods, which could be converted into plutonium, which could be converted into weapons, is a very, very difficult situation. I think the administration is correct in getting China heavily involved. China has got to be involved. I think the administration at some point has to put on the table, in effect, a quid pro quo. You get rid of your nuclear program, and here's the light at the end of the tunnel for your economy and for your people. But you've got to reduce the nuclear threat, and you've got to do it in a transparent and objective way. Bob has been heavily engaged in this kind of negotiation in the past. So, Bob, you want to add to that?
Let me just add something about your question about expertise and Al-Qaeda access to that. It was very unnerving a few years ago when we learned that some senior former officials of the Pakistani Atomic Energy Commission had engaged in a number of discussions with Osama bin Laden, and they were talking about nuclear weapons and how to get them. Pakistani authorities have assured us that no actual technology, materials, equipment was passed to Osama bin Laden at that time. But it's of concern that Al-Qaeda is interested in getting their hands on that material and expertise. And the people problem is fundamental. We have to deal with the scientists who might be tempted to help the terrorists for one reason or another, whether it's for personal profit, out of ideology, or what have you. And so the people problem is essential. We're taking steps with Pakistan to try to ensure that they put the necessary controls on their nuclear expertise. We have been doing the same thing with Russia, but we have to solve the people problem.
If I could just add to complete the Al-Qaeda picture, in addition to the contacts that we know they had with the Pakistani complex, we've also had at least two arrests of Al-Qaeda operatives in the 90s of trying to obtain HEU. And Al-Qaeda, as you know, operates on very long timelines. They're very patient. They're very persistent. They have made it clear that they're going after HEU. They've made at least two attempts that we don't know of. We don't know of what other attempts they may have made, whether they've been successful or not. We also, in Afghanistan, when we went into Afghanistan, discovered a trove of documents in an Al-Qaeda safe house that had very, shall we say, plausible, workable weapons designs. Demonstrated a very clear understanding of simple gun-type weapons designs for nuclear weapons. So this is a project in which they are clearly involved in, and that's why I refer to this as a race. It is they are working hard on this issue, and we are not going fast enough to try to stop them.
Let me ask just one follow-up really quickly. Do you all have faith in what the Pakistanis have to say on this front? And two, $4 billion a month the U.S. is spending in just Iraq, and that's not including Afghanistan. You say you're $3 billion short on just pledges for this effort, $4 billion a month in Iraq. Should that money and those resources and that attention have been refocused? Should they be refocused now on what you see as the front burner threat?
Well, I think the opportunity cost in Iraq is going to have to be weighed very heavily, and part of the debate in this country ought to be about that. But we're there now, and whatever mistakes have been made have been made, and the question is how you get the ox out of the ditch now. The ox is clearly in the ditch in Iraq. But if you look at the amount of money, I mentioned $30 billion is what the Baker-Cutler Commission thought it would take to basically secure all the nuclear weapons material in the former Soviet Union. We'll spend more than that in the next 3 or 4 months in Iraq. But that job remains undone. So you look at the cost and the opportunity cost, and you have to question the priorities when you look at the overall security threat around the globe. But again, we're there, and the question now is what to do about Iraq, and that's a totally another set of questions. But the opportunity cost has been extremely high.
Let me just follow on that. Supposing Iraq were to become a failed state, Iraq is nowhere mentioned here, as I can tell, among the problems. But supposing the worst thing happens and the whole thing falls apart and splinters and other countries come in and try to grab their share and Iraq becomes what we describe Afghanistan to have been, or perhaps still is, a failed state, what does that do to complicate the overall nuclear threat initiative?
I think any failed state makes it harder because it makes it easier. A failed state makes it easier by definition for groups to operate in a sort of atmosphere of chaos. So I think it makes it much harder. In terms of the actual number of nuclear materials there, this is not a place that has a high level of nuclear materials at this stage based on David Kay report, based on IAEA. So Iraq may be the most searched place on the face of the globe in terms of nuclear materials. Biological and chemical, in my view, has always been more know-how than actual materials, because materials on the biological and chemical are eminently controllable by various groups if they have the know-how to make them. And this is where you get into what Bob mentioned about cooperation on scientists and keeping the know-how out of the hands. You're not going to be able to completely secure every bit of chemical and biological material in the world, although that ought to be our goal.
So our failure to find weapons of mass destruction is really good news then?
Our failure to find weapons of mass destruction. Well, let me put it this way. The worst news would be if we found that they had weapons of mass destruction and they all were taken out of there. And then the question would be where they are. Now, I haven't seen evidence of that. That would be the worst case because we wouldn't know where they were. I always have feared and still fear, particularly on the nuclear side, that the use of nuclear weapons is much more likely by a group that doesn't have a return address. We still have a very strong deterrence against another nation launching a nuclear missile or attack or even a bomber against the United States. We know where they are. We know where they come from. And there would certainly be a measure of very heavy retaliation. But a group that does not have a return address, and particularly the suicidal groups with the nuclear material, would be a real hazard to the world. And the same thing would be true with chemical and biological.
To return to the sun.
Yeah, I think Marty was next, and we'll come up back.
Thank you. In all of your comments, three of you, you talked about the need for transparency in nuclear, chemical, biological sites. The U.S. has to know what Russia's got, Russia has to know what the U.S. has, other nations as well. But especially, Bob, I'm going to talk about the fact that some of the most the nuclear sites that are most troubling in Russia, the U.S. has not been given proper access to it. And conservatives on the Hill have used this as a reason in the past to halt funding, freeze funding for the non-removal program, etc. So I guess the question is, why has this not been made a top-level concern by President Bush of President Putin has hasn't been. And could you also address why is it so important the United States must have access to these most vital nuclear sites in order to do the cleanup? What reciprocity has the U.S. offered in exchange for asking for that?
The several questions, why has this not been made a high priority between President Bush and President Putin? I have no answer for that. It should be a high priority. Every summit meeting between President Bush and President Putin, there ought to be a discussion of what obstacles remain and how you cut through them. But beyond that, they ought to be talking on the telephone every week. And the people in Russia ought to be asking these questions of their own government. It's not simply U.S. government. This cannot be just the U.S. It's got to be Russia as well as the U.S. We ought to be demanding this kind of leadership from President Bush, and the Russian people ought to be demanding it from President Putin. They need to cut through the obstacles. The other questions, Marty, which would be your second?
The importance of the need for the United States to even be at these nuclear sites, and why that is indeed an obstacle. Does the U.S. not trust Russia to say, hey, we're cleaning it up or we're taking care of it, just give us the money?
Well, from an accountability of funds point of view, it's understandable that we want to make sure our funds are being spent in the way we intend them to be spent. So I think that accountability of funds point of view is important. I believe, though, that the Russians have all the nuclear inventory they need to destroy the United States. They've had it for 30-something years. To believe that they now need another 10 weapons converted from material that we are doing, to me, on the security side, I don't think the questions are very profound. But I do think on the accountability side they are. I would add, though, that the biggest suspicion is on the biological side, where we have not had any transparency from the Russian military. We have on the civilian. And that's the missing element. Your other question, reciprocity, I think there has to be some reciprocity. I think we have to be more open with selected Russian representatives so that they have a degree of psychological assurance that this is a two-way street. Again, some people on the Hill would say, why should we open up? We're paying the money. They're not helping us. Well, it's a matter of our own security. Is it in our interest for the Russians to realize, for instance, on the biological defensive efforts, that we aren't building offensive weapons? Absolutely, it's in our interest. Because if they know we're not, they have no real reason to do that themselves. Or if they do, we know that there's terrible intent behind it. So there's got to be a degree of transparency on both sides, and I think that means the United States has to be willing to have more reciprocity.
Including nuclear, by the way, in the nuclear sites?
I think the reciprocity on the nuclear side, we've already had some. We have had visits to our laboratories. We've had Sig Hecker and a lot of people from Los Alamos have been over to Russia. There's been a tremendous amount of viewpoints exchanged, and I think they found it very useful. Both sides have. So we've had that, but do we need more? Yeah, we do.
If I could just add one thought on this. I think the accountability concerns of Congress are real and legitimate, but I also think they have to be weighed against the threat and the urgency that we face. One of the things that I personally have proposed, I'm speaking personally, not for the project, is the idea of let's go ahead and rely on the Russians, who we've been working with very closely, who have done the 43% of the material security so far, and rely on those same people who know what a good system looks like now. They know how to put it in. They know how to work it. And ask them to do rapid upgrades immediately everywhere, with or without our access. Let's just get something in place to raise the bar for terrorists to try to at least secure everything to a certain degree. Then we can go back and work the accountability issues, work the access issues for a more comprehensive set of upgrades. My concern is there's still more than half of this material sitting there without any upgrades whatsoever because of these bureaucratic wranglings. There are some compromises that need to be made on both sides to urgently address the threat, and it is very real.
This is the one thing that can be done without money.
Yes, absolutely. The money's there. It's a matter of being
leadership.
Able to spend it.
This is leadership. I'm reminded of the old, you guys in this room and are not old enough to remember the old, Marty, you may be, the old Groucho, the Marx Brothers, you know, the cartoon where He's standing over by a window on a ledge, and he has Groucho has a gun up to his head. The thugs are coming toward him with knives, and he says, "One more step, and I'll pull the trigger." You know, that's kind of the way Russia and the United States are. We're not looking at the broad security business. On the biological side, which is more likely, that we'll have a terrorist use of biological weapons, or Russia that has had huge biological inventories? For years, for 30, 40 years, they've had a biological effort going on, even after they agreed not to. But which is more likely? We'll get attacked with Russia, a deliberate biological attack on the United States? I hardly think so. I mean, I think that the threat of a terrorist group gaining control of these materials or access to a Russian scientist, putting him on the payroll, is like 10,000 times more risk than a deliberate biological attack. And particularly if we had transparency, I think the dangers of attack would go way down. And I believe that the defensive research, quote, defensive research that is ongoing in our country, admittedly, and also probably in Russia, we would be able to remove the clouds and suspicions that really may be offensive. There's a thin line on the biological side between defensive research and offensive intent. And that line is one that can only be dealt with. I think at first it needs to be bilateral. I don't think we need to open this up to the whole world. It's dangerous information and so forth. It can be highly classified, but it can be bilateral between the United States and Russia. Then later we can get other countries involved as we build confidence. So that step would unlock so much of this suspicion that I strongly, strongly urge that our government and the Russian government consider it.
Last year at Evian, the level of attention that was devoted to global partnership issues was not as much as would be necessary to get an agenda like this moving forward. Why can we hope that this year will be different, and what's different this year to bring that about?
Michelle? I think that the Bush administration is going into this summit with nonproliferation as one of its priority areas, the global partnership being one of several initiatives that it is pushing. I think that, you know, it's not clear whether or not the leaders are going to give this adequate attention, and that's why we're here today, because we are calling on them to maintain and actually increase the momentum. It's fine to have cooperation at a sort of workmanlike pace if you think you have multiple years to solve a problem. But if you think that al-Qaeda's been working on this for more than a decade, which they have, and you think that there's some evidence that they've made substantial progress, we don't have a lot of time. And this requires a much more urgent response. We cannot wait till the day after to wonder what we wish we would have done differently. And I applaud the administration for the announcement they're making today in Vienna. It's essential. It's a very, very important step forward if it's fully realized. We need to take that. It's a perfect way to build some momentum going into Seattle and to say, okay, we took this step. This is one piece of the puzzle. Now let's put some more other pieces on the table and have some real leadership in Seattle.
It really is a question, a good question, because so many of these initiatives that appear with a lot of fanfare initially, tend to lose interest in the publics and among the governments that have initially agreed. It becomes business as usual. I don't think it has become business as usual yet as far as the G8 countries in the U.S. and Russia are concerned, but it needs continuous reinvigoration if it's going to get the attention it deserves.
Nobody votes for the G8 as a group, but the individual citizens of individual countries have to know about these threats, and they have to also know that the G8 has pledged to meet these threats, and they have to hold their own leadership accountable in the democratic process. And I think we have to do that here. Russia has to do it, and the other G8 countries have to do it. That's what information and education is all about, and that's one of the main purposes of this consortium. We're working in every country that's in the G8, plus a lot of other countries.
With regard to the initiative and Russia's buy-in, you had mentioned it, Senator. that we need to get Russia to buy in. What effort is going to be made by this group to deal with the Duma, to deal with Russia in promoting this agenda to get at least their buy-in on the priorities that's been set? It goes nowhere if Russia doesn't buy in.
Absolutely right. The question's on Russian buy-in, and how do you get the Duma to step up to the plate on this? The way we are trying to do it, and we haven't certainly not completely succeeded now, but our organization outside, not government, is we've got two Russian members on our NTI Foundation board. One of them's picture is right up there, standing right to the left of Ted Turner, Andrei Kokoshin. Andrei was the Deputy Minister of Defense under Yeltsin. He's also a member of the Duma. So Andrei is a real leader in Russia, and he's certainly part of this agenda. In addition, Michelle and Bob have put together two Russian think tanks, and those think tanks are part of this consortium group. We hope that will have some real impact and influence. We have our NTI Foundation has funded two Russian studies on the whole alert posture and hair trigger that I alluded to of nuclear forces. We had one of those presentations last week to our board here in Washington by a Russian. We will have another one soon, and those are being led by top defense experts in Russia. So we're doing what we can from the outside. But the real crux of this is President Bush and President Putin. They've got to lead, and if President Putin leads on this subject, if President Bush makes it a top priority, I think you'll see both the U.S. Congress and the Duma be much, much more receptive on a lot of removing a lot of obstacles on their side and on our side. So the key here is sustained leadership, focused leadership.
Can I say something about Russian buy-in? We do have Russian buy-in, but the Russians have, understandably, have their own priorities. They're giving a high priority to the dismantlement of the decommissioned nuclear submarines and to the destruction of chemical weapons. These are the big-ticket items. They're a huge element in the Russian treasury. So it's understandable that they would put a lot of priority on that. But we need to figure out what should be the highest priorities if your goal is to prevent WMD terrorism. And if that's really your goal, I think you want to put more focus on matters like securing nuclear materials, on dealing with concerns about biological pathogens. Senator Nunn mentioned that the former Soviet military biological facilities, we have no access to them whatsoever. We've exchanged almost no information about that. This is a big black hole in the global partnership, this question of former military facilities. That's where we have to put a lot of effort, and it will take presidential leadership to get these efforts focused on matters of the highest priority.
Just a minute, because what's happening in Russia, at least to some degree, is almost what's happened in the CTR program, which you negotiated through Congress. It became, in good deal, an American jobs program. At least in one instance, I know of a deputy in the Duma who has said, yeah, if you want me to ratify the plutonium disposition agreement or the CTR agreement as liability, I want the BN-600 to be part of the plutonium disposition program. Now, people can laugh at that, but if we look back at the CTR program, and we've talked about that a long time ago, Senator, that's exactly what happened here. We had schools in Alaska doing things. And so are we really getting into the negotiations with in the political realm with some of these ideas to get these deputies to support the programs? And yeah. The BN-600, by the way, would look almost counter to some of the things that we're looking at as far as it's a fast reactor. We're worrying about a breeder, and so it runs counter to it, but yet there's a strong effort to put this reactor in Russia.
Well, I think the question indicates that pork barreling is a problem with all of these programs, and that's part of our democratic process. Everybody would like to create jobs in their own district with whatever defense funds are being spent. You have to have public education, and you have to have leaders rise above that so that you put the priorities where the priorities are, and then the jobs are a fallout from the real priorities. But if the jobs become the main driving force, then you obviously waste a lot of money. So I don't have an answer for this anymore in Russia and the Duma than I do
in the U.S. Congress, we still have, according to John McCain, my friend John McCain, we still have some of that pork barreling going on in the U.S. Congress.
Yeah. Here, though, at that level, besides the higher level that we're proposing here?
I'm not sure that what that question is. It's,
We negotiated the CTR program, as you admit, doing a lot of pork barreling, but we got a good program out. Some degree of that negotiations from groups like this, or at least presented to the deputy, seems to be, would be helpful in getting the program at least to the first stage.
I guess I would approach it a different way, and that is, you know, Senator Nunn talked about getting leaders to rise above that dynamic in crafting these programs. I think this gets to the question of threat perception, of having real senior-level dialogues with Russians about the threats to them. This is not, if you look at this just as an assistance program, the dynamics you're talking about are going to take over. If the Russians believe that either, you know, having materials from Russia get out and be used against someone else in a catastrophic attack would be horrible for their relationships and role in the world and everything else, or if you convince that, that actually there may be terrorist groups who would like to use the materials against them, if you have that overarching aha moment in terms of threat perception, you're going to see very different behavior in terms of moving forward on these programs. One of the things that I'll just give you an example of this that I've observed, we've observed in Europe. We just had an exercise there, as Senator Nunn mentioned, in early May. Since Madrid, Europe is in the process of having that aha moment, that they understand that the terrorist cells are operating in Europe, they're targeting Europe, that Europe is not just on the sidelines here watching this happen to the United States or happen to someone else. It could happen to Europe. And that realization has motivated a completely different level of dialogue and thinking inside Europe on these issues that's just beginning now. So I think if that's where we should be focused with Russia, having Russia Russian leaders internalize the understanding of what this would mean for Russia if it really happened, and to move forward on that basis.
The head of the Russian FSB just there was a news release this last week where he basically said that the terrorists were much further along the path of gaining access to nuclear material and know-how than they had been. That's somewhat of a breakthrough in terms of an admission at a very high level in Russia that there's a real problem, and the problem relates to Russia itself. So you can get these kind of acknowledgments by Russians in quiet conversations, but having their leadership really step up and explain the threat to their own people, I think Michelle is absolutely right. I think that's the key.
Senator, just a couple of, you say $17 billion has been pledged to date, but that excludes $2 billion pledged by Russia. Mm-hmm. Why?
Our own position is that Russia is the country that is the recipient, and to have that $2 billion, which was already pre-existing, count as a pledge against fresh money would be somewhat of a distortion, because the $10 billion the United States pledged was already conditioned to some extent on Russian cooperation and participation. I think our government took the same position. Bob, you might want to.
No, that's right. I mean, not surprisingly, both U.S. and Russia agree that its $2 billion should not be included among the $20 billion. Naturally, both the U.S. and Russia want more funds to be raised, so we set the Russian $2 billion aside. Some of the other G8 partners would like to include the Russian $2 billion in part so that their burden would not be as great as it would otherwise be.
But it is, I understand it, it is your position that, in fact, the $20 billion is, in any case, not sufficient.
It's a floor, not a ceiling.
It's a floor, not a ceiling. Right. All right, now, a second question. Is this $20 billion really only concerned with Russian-related weapons of mass destruction? In other words, is it not questioning what it'll cost us to handle North Korea, Pakistan, other places?
I think it's Russia and the former Soviet Union. It would include countries like Kazakhstan, Belarus, those countries, but it's primarily Russia and the former Soviet Union. It should be a global worldwide effort, but I know the funding itself would be inadequate to that kind of task.
Senator Lugar has talked about a non-Lugar program for North Korea. If we ever reach a breakthrough in the negotiations, I completely endorse that approach. It'd be different. It'd be another set of funding. But we also would need to get countries like Japan. Japan's part of this G8. Frankly, Japan hadn't done enough. They're nowhere near what they should be doing. But they are helping some, and they're helping on submarines. But a North Korean breakthrough in negotiation would demand that the Japanese, as well as I think the Chinese, step up to the plate with another whole set of funding.
My final question is this. For those of us who have very few words in which to convey the main message of this meeting, would one of you care to try to see if there's two or three key sentences that the public should be aware of in all the countries that are affected by this?
My concise explanation of this is that the greatest security threat in the 21st century is the threat of weapons of mass destruction. The most likely use of those weapons of mass destruction is in the hands of terrorists. The highest priority in preventing catastrophic terrorism must be to keep nuclear, chemical, and biological materials out of the hands of terrorists. And in that regard, we're in a race between cooperation and catastrophe. That would be my summary.
And is there a way to say what role Sea Island plays in all this?
Well, it's an important summit. If the leadership of this G8 summit is going to be satisfied with taking a picture and having photo opportunities and making announcements, new announcements, and forgetting the previous commitments and announcements, then Sea Island will not be very significant. If, however, the leadership begins to answer these fundamental questions that we posed this morning about the real security interest of the world and the threats and the gaps between the threat and the responses, then Sea Island can be a very significant breakthrough in making the global partnership not only a series of pledges, but a reality.
One more money question, and that is, and perhaps it's in the materials and I've just overlooked it, do we know what percentage of the pledges has actually been realized? We're 2 years along. Do we have 20% of it?
In terms of actual programs?
Yeah, what money actually in the till, actually funding programs?
We don't have an exact figure. It's hard. It's difficult to compare, apples and oranges here. But you can you realize you have to divide the $17 billion by 10 to get the annual figure, and only a small fraction of that figure has actually been committed to specific projects. We don't have the exact data for you.
Can you give us a feel of how small?
The U.S. part, $10 billion of that 20 was already previously committed by the U.S., although they nailed it down to make it 10 years. That's the non-Lugar program. That money is being expended each year. So you got $600-800 million that are being spent each year now by the United States. The other element, the added, is the match of the G8 of that $1 billion per year. In my view, the amount of that match that has been converted to actual programs would be very small. I don't know what the estimate would be. My guess is if you took that second $10 billion, and you divided it by 10, which means $1 billion a year, and you said how much of the $1 billion was spent in 2003 by the G8 countries, I would guess no more than 10-15%. But, Bob, you could...
That's about right, but we can try to get you figures, but it's hard.
Over here. You mentioned that Japan hasn't done enough. I was wondering if you can expand on that. What haven't they done? What should they be doing? And what should the U.S. do to encourage a more active role on their part?
Well, the Japanese have their own experience. In 1995, they had the Amshin Rikyo attack by a cult in Japan. I think that was a real wake-up call for Japanese. So I think having been assaulted with a chemical attack in Tokyo, the Japanese would want to step up on the chemical. I think they'd also want to step up on the nuclear submarine dismantlement. They've done some things in that regard, and they've run into bureaucratic problems. Again, high-level leadership is going to be necessary. So I would say those would be natural. The submarines are right there in their backyard, and the deterioration of those nuclear reactors in the oceans near Japan could have a huge effect on their fisheries, their food supply, and on the environment. So those would be two very natural areas. And, of course, I would expect the Japanese would be more focused if we do get a breakthrough with North Korea. But the Japanese are part of this G8. They have basically been part of the area that we were most concerned about in protecting in the whole Cold War. The United States and Japan have been key allies in the Cold War. A whole lot of this arsenal was built up during the Cold War. So I think in addition to their own security, I think the Japanese have a real obligation to help in the dismantling, safe dismantling and security of the Cold War military arsenals.
This is another area where the Japanese could be very active. They're interested in plutonium disposition, taking Russian former weapons plutonium, converting it into reactor fuel and burning it in nuclear power reactors. It's a big project, $2 billion effort to get this going in Russia. Unfortunately, it's been stalled because of a disagreement essentially between the U.S. and Russia about liability protections for American workers. This, again, is a question of leadership. It's an excruciatingly difficult technical question, legal question, but it's a kind of question that can easily be resolved if you have enough impetus from the top. If once this liability question is cleared away, this plutonium disposition project can move forward, and I think Japan could be an important contributor to that. But there's no question, if you look at the totals there, the $200 million pledged, that's well below what Japan is capable of pledging. But we will see whether it is prepared to step up to the plate.
The Amshin Rikyo cult had people that were actually part of the cult, several hundred, maybe even thousands of people in Russia that were part of the Amshin Rikyo cult. They also had penetrated Russian nuclear facilities and had people that were members of the cult in Russian facilities. They also had a radio station in Vladivostok. The Amshin Rikyo group. So there are enough ties directly to an attack that's already occurred with chemical weapons in Japan to the Russian aftermath of the Cold War and the lack of security for any Japanese leader to be able, in my view, to stand up and say this has got to be a part of our national security approach, and we basically have an obligation to the world to help on this, and also we have an obligation in terms of stepping up to the plate and protecting our own security.
I've got a follow-up on the Japan issue. Do they have a problem stockpiling of their own reactor fuel for their... obviously, they were trying to deplete the reactors and so forth, and they've been reprocessing and processing in Europe and bringing materials back, which they promised not to keep in large volume. Now they've been forced to because of an accident, you know, shut down their own usage.
They have a huge stockpile of plutonium. And the Japanese, probably more than any country I know other than France, have a real stake in the nuclear power industry. And, of course, if you have a nuclear catastrophic disaster or even radiological weapons being used, I think it has a negative effect on the use of nuclear power in Japan, in France, in this country, and around the globe. I think the nuclear chain is one that the public opinion doesn't distinguish between a nuclear disaster involving a weapon and a nuclear disaster involving a power plant. And so I think the reality is the nuclear power industry has a big stake, civilian side, in the safety of all nuclear material from cradle to grave. All of us do. Okay, I think... we probably exhausted all knowledge, if not your questions. Thank you.